Chapter 3. An Alternative Model. Introduction. Well, enough of the inadequacies of the presently dominant principles and model. Among the alternative principles that have come from our discussion so far are the need to begin by identifying what most matters about a topic, in the what's the story on this sense, the need to structure the topic on the powerful binary abstract concepts that children so easily grasp and grasp new knowledge with, the need to lay out our unit or lesson in a story form, the need to conclude by satisfying the expectation or resolving, perhaps by mediating, the conflict set up at the beginning. It is not difficult now to put these alternative principles to work in a new model for planning teaching. Following Tyler's example, I will lay out the model as a series of questions. Providing answers to these questions produces a lesson or unit plan. After laying out the model, I will discuss how to use it and make some comments about it. Rather than do this in the abstract, I will take two examples. First, I will show how the model might be used to produce a plan for teaching a unit on communities for six-year-olds. Then I will use it to plan a lesson on the Vikings for children of the same age. By planning a topic which is common in curricula in North America and Australia during the early grades, and increasingly common in Great Britain and Ireland, I hope to show how the alternative principles embodied in this alternative model produce a significantly different learning experience for children. I hope readers will agree that it is likely to be more educationally valuable than what typically results from using some form of the presently dominant model. My purpose in providing a brief plan for a lesson on the Vikings is to exemplify some of the principles discussed in the previous two chapters. The influence of research focused almost exclusively on a limited range of logical skills has led to the exclusion of topics from ancient or medieval history from the early years of schooling. There are, of course, other arguments given for beginning with less distant topics, and I will consider some of them in Chapter 5. But significant among the reasons for the exclusion of such a topic is the claim that young children cannot understand it in any meaningful way. It is supposed to require concepts which young children do not typically develop until much later. Also, by applying the ad hoc principle that learning proceeds from the known to the unknown, it is only after a number of years of schooling that children's understanding can be expanded to grasp a topic which involves so much that it is different from their daily experience. The two examples are social studies topics, because these are most easily accessible to all readers. I have suggested that this model can be applied also to subjects which are not so rich in events, such as mathematics and science. In the following chapter, then, I will consider how this model can be used in planning teaching in various curriculum areas. Applying the model. The principles discussed in the first two chapters have implications not only for how we should plan teaching, but clearly, as part of our planning, perhaps, they direct us towards some kinds of content rather than others. The very first question of the model implies that if we cannot find anything affectively engaging in a topic, then we should go no further. That is, the question provides also a criterion for inclusion in or exclusion from our curriculum. Now, we can find something affectively engaging about almost anything, but clearly some things lend themselves better than others, if this is a criterion for selecting content. This is a matter I will discuss in Chapter 5, but I raise it here because the first example, communities, is a topic I would prefer to leave out of my early school curriculum. I will explain why in Chapter 5, but essentially it is because I think such a topic is not easy to make both meaningful and educationally valuable for young children. I nevertheless have chosen it simply because it is a very common topic in many parts of the Western world during the early school years. That is, teachers are familiar with such a topic. They have to teach it because it is prescribed, and they have plans for teaching it which can be readily compared with the product of applying this model. I want to show also that one can plan a unit on medieval history which is accessible, engaging, and educationally valuable for young children. The reason for juxtaposing the two will be brought out in Chapter 5. But the point here is to exemplify the model with varied material, so let us turn to that. The story form model. 1. Identifying importance. What is most important about this topic? Why should it matter to children? What is effectively engaging about it? 2. Finding binary opposites. What powerful binary opposites best catch the importance of the topic? 3. Organizing content into story form. 3.1. What content most dramatically embodies the binary opposites in order to provide access to the topic? 3.2. What content best articulates the topic into a developing story form? 4. Conclusion. What is the best way of resolving the dramatic conflict inherent in the binary opposites? What degree of mediation of those opposites is it appropriate to seek? 5. Evaluation. How can one know whether the topic has been understood, its importance grasped, and the content learned. I am recommending that we should approach a unit on communities as a story to be told, rather than as a set of objectives that is to be attained. We should remember that stories can be true as well as fictional, and that shaping material into a story form may involve simplification, but need not at all involve falsification. Also, we should remember that in a well-wrought story, there is room for detailed knowledge and inference and discovery processes and much else. We might orient ourselves by imagining a newspaper editor on some distant planet asking his investigative reporters from Earth, "What's the story on these communities? What am I going to tell our readers?" 1. Identifying importance. What is most important about this topic? Why should it matter to children? What is affectively engaging about it? Communities are networks of supports, protections, affections, beliefs, and so on. They are held together by our mutual needs and desires, and they are threatened by our tendency to value our needs and desires excessively highly and those of others excessively lowly. They are also threatened by natural catastrophes that smash the complex network of supports, protections, affections, beliefs, and so on. Communities are the products of unwritten social contracts we enter into with each other. These generate a kind of social organism that protects us from destruction and enables the satisfaction of our desires. To say that children are parts of a community and the community is vitally important does not establish that the topic can easily be made affectively engaging. Children take their everyday lives too much for granted to be able to reflect on them in a way that makes them intellectually engaging. Fish probably do not find water very interesting until they are pulled out of it. Perhaps this observation provides us with one way towards making the topic affectively engaging. Children tend to take their community routines as natural, so we must find a way of showing those routines as vividly dramatic and not simply as prosaic everyday experience. Underlying the prosaic routines that form the visible surface of our communities, there are vital needs being met, desperate fears being allayed, incredible hopes being made possible, and so on. To make our topic affectively engaging, it is this dramatic and real level underlying the routines of community life that must be exposed. This is what is important. This is the real story on human communities. Now, we need not present this underlying reality in some nightmare-inducing form as horrors from the deep. But at the same time, we need to recall our earlier discussion of how children use the most dramatic and powerful concepts to make sense of things. The typical presentation of this topic dwells on the prosaic routines, and so remains affectively unengaging and, in any profound sense, largely meaningless. In order to justify the place of this topic in the early school curriculum, we need to show that it can be structured on the kinds of powerful concepts children use to grasp new knowledge. Let us see whether we can catch something of what is really important about communities in terms of these concepts. 2. Finding binary opposites. What powerful binary opposites best catch the importance of the topic? What binary opposites best catch and allow us to expose the underlying drama of everyday community living? We need to see the prosaic parts, milk delivery, the mall, shopping, roads and telephones, etc., as one of the greatest achievements of human ingenuity and planning. What is at stake in a community is not just our superficial comforts and conveniences, but life itself. If our community ceases to function, we die. There are a number of binary opposites we might choose to express aspects of this view of the function of communities. Why not pause from reading for a minute and see how many you can come up with, and which you would choose as most generally useful? Given what I have identified as important about the topic, I will use the binary opposites of survival/destruction. We could have focused on a slightly less dramatic level with security/danger. We might have considered the dynamics of a community through competition/cooperation. Other, perhaps more superficial aspects of the community might be exposed by use of dependence/independence. An historical perspective might have been brought to the fore through the choice of change/stability. We have reached survival destruction by looking at the topic of communities through the prominent conceptual forms the child already has in place. Our model directs us to these by demanding first that we focus on what is most important about a topic. One of the ad hoc principles I did not pursue in the first chapter is the claim that children's understanding proceeds from the simple to the complex. This has encouraged teachers and curriculum designers to begin with the simpler, more superficial aspects of topics. From observations of children's stories, it seems clear that from the simple to the complex is, again, inadequate as an account of the development of children's understanding. Our earliest understanding is of profound things. One might say that as we learn some of the most important, profound, and powerful concepts very early, and thereafter we refine and elaborate them. So, perhaps ironically, in the face of the presently dominant ad hoc principles, it is the most profound and important aspects of a topic that need to be brought to the fore if we want young children to understand it. 3. Organizing content into story form. 3.1. What content most dramatically embodies the binary opposites in order to provide access to the topic? We need to begin our story unit with an event, or incident, or example that most vividly shows communities as not just people doing different jobs and depending on each other for various commodities, but rather as a matter of survival against destruction. We might begin by setting out a scenario for the children. Suppose when we wake up, tomorrow, our village, town, or city is cut off from the rest of North America, Australia, or Europe. Say there is a huge steel wall all around our community. All the roads just run to a stop against it. It cuts off the telephone wires. It is too high to fly over, and too deep to dig under, and too thick and strong to smash. It cuts off all the pipes under the ground, too. After giving the children a chance to discuss the characteristics of the wall, the teacher can focus back to the point that it cuts us off from everyone outside our own immediate community. If the water pipes that lead to our taps are cut, where will we get water? How long would our food last? What would happen if there was no electricity and the gasoline runs out? Either as a follow-on discussion or as an alternative, we might extend the scenario by saying that the next day, or a few days later, we wake up to find another steel wall around our house, apartment, or igloo. Now what happens? Well, no doubt experienced teachers might come up with a dozen better openers. The point is that we need a beginning activity that gives dramatic point to the concept of a community as a machine which people have made to help our survival and fend off destruction. It is something vitally important for our daily survival. We simply cannot take it for granted. 3.2. What content best articulates the topic into a developing story form? This question directs us not simply to gather in a list all the things we consider relevant to the topic of communities. Rather, it requires that we select content according to the binary opposites chosen to express the most important aspects of the topic. Each item will be selected in order to give further expression and elaboration to our survival destruction organizers. As in any good story, we must keep to our plot line, or else we will dissipate meaning. Our plot line is given in the conflict set up between the forces that enable our survival in the face of the various threats of destruction. This model requires that all content be tied to this line. No doubt, much of the content of this unit will be similar to that used when it is planned by any other model. The differences will be in organization, in the focus on particular aspects of the content rather than others, and also in tone. The tone determined by this model requires that the unit be taken seriously. This does not mean it need be dull and somber. Rather, it means that the content must be recognized as important. A lot turns on whether children become educated or not. It is serious business, and this model reinforces this fact at every stage of planning. If we consider food, for example, it will be insufficient to describe the kinds of foods available in a local supermarket and the routes they take to get there. Our binary opposites focus attention on food as a means of survival, and also on the threats of destruction. Now, obviously, when dealing with food, this is always implied. Here, however, it has to be made explicit and central. Our unit is not about food, but about survival. That is, the focus is on what variety of foods we need to survive. We can then distinguish between necessities and the abundance available at a Western supermarket, whose purpose is to satisfy unessential matters of taste. Having made such a distinction, our binary organizers direct us to focus on the essentials. We will then focus on the problems in getting those to the supermarket and the threats to that process. We already know what will happen if these necessities fail to be delivered regularly, but we can discount the steel wall as a realistic threat. The steel wall, however, is a kind of analogy for all the other threats. Our focus will be on the threats to crops and how these are defended against: weather, petroleum products, fertilizers, insecticides, etc. On the problems of keeping food from rotting during transportation, perhaps including here the dramatic story of the first refrigerated rail cars. On the threats to the transportation system, vast systems of rail and road machinery, and industries producing rail cars and trucks, and the threats to the supply lines for all the components and fuel supply problems. One product of this manner of presenting the way our community makes food available to its members is that it shows the supermarket not as a routine, prosaic aspect of community life, but as one of the wonders of the world. The ad hoc principles disputed earlier suggest that we should expand outwards from what is familiar to children. A more important early educational principle has been stated by Bertrand Russell as the need to destroy the tyranny of the local over the imagination. The educational achievement is not to make the strange seem familiar, but to make the familiar seem strange. It is seeing the wonderful that lies hidden in what we take for granted that matters educationally. Provincialism is education's first and most tenacious enemy. This model builds in principles to help us combat taking the world for granted. In this case, the supermarket is seen as a miracle of human ingenuity and organizational skill. To properly grasp that miracle, it has to be seen in the context of the threats to its achievement and continuation. Again, this need not be presented as a nightmare-inducing scenario. What is educationally important is letting the children's binary conceptual structures, developed, defined, and elaborated in significant part by their use in fantasy stories, grasp the real world. Fantasy, in this view, is a kind of early conceptual workshop where powerful conceptual tools are forged and elaborated. The educational task is then to use these powerful tools in making sense of reality. We do not attach them to reality if we present only the routine surfaces of everyday life. There is nothing there for children to get much of a grip on. It is by introducing knowledge organized in terms of these powerful underlying concepts that we provide children with a grasp on reality. We continue to use survival destruction as the criterion for selecting content for our unit. We will look at the range of possible content, not as a list of relevant topics, but as a coordinated set of strategies for survival. Thus, we can consider our basic human needs and consider the ways that the community fulfills them and defends against potential threats to them. So we might, for example, consider the role of servicemen. It is not just that a cheerful man comes and fixes mummy's dryer when it breaks down, but that this man or woman and many others are the repositories of skilled knowledge needed for our survival in a technological society. One obviously does not present it to children in these terms, but our binary organizers direct us to see the serviceman in terms of our plotline. We are directed also to consider the threats to those service functions. What if the machines stop and there is no one who knows how to fix them? How do communities ensure there are people who know how to fix all the different kinds of machines we rely on? It is appropriate in this context to consider not just an idealized view of there being so many helpers in the community, but rather that most people are absolutely dependent on the machines running and being fixed. Again, the system of defenses against our technological traps are not seen as routines, but wonders of complex organization. There is nothing quite as amazing as our communities may well be a part of the lesson of this unit. Well, I am in danger of going on endlessly elaborating the same point with lots of similar examples. I hope it is clear how our survival-destruction binary opposites can be used to select and organize the content that will carry our story forward. Each part adds to the image of the community as a complex machine designed to defend us against destruction. I chose that binary pair as basic organizers as a result of deciding what seemed to me most important to teach children about communities. It will be clear that another side of the power of such organizers in selecting and organizing content is that they also serve to exclude a great deal. They provide a perspective that will give greater prominence to the role of police than to the role of, say, mail delivery. That is, all those community functions designed most directly to support survival against threats will be more centrally located on our plot line. This need not exclude the mailman and community center, of course. By identifying ties of affection as a basic human need, the role of the mailman becomes included in our plot. Again, however, our educational purpose will be served by making the familiar strange, by making the routines of mail delivery comprehensible, as a truly amazing achievement. From almost anywhere in the world, for a very small amount of money, one can have a letter delivered to almost anywhere else. Perhaps the amazement of this achievement can be brought out by considering the great steps towards the present routine: the British penny black postage stamp, the Pony Express, the arrangements for mail delivery with other countries, and the Universal Postal Union. Postage stamps from around the world acclaiming this achievement might be displayed. Elsewhere, I have written about differences between socializing and educating. In teaching a unit on communities, the differences become important. In socializing, we aim to make students familiar with their environment, at home in its routines, comfortable with its norms and values, and the social expectations to which they should conform. This is, I think, the usual aim of teaching about communities in early years. My alternative model, by demanding first that we reflect on the importance of the topic for the child's education, will tend to bring educational considerations to the fore. Socializing most effectively happens simply by living in societies day by day, and schools are generally rather ineffective socializing institutions when they try to teach what is best learned from out-of-school experience. And further, by attempting to perform the socializing role at which they are ineffective, schools tend to undercut their educational role. This is what we often see in the teaching of subjects like communities. If a person does not know what a supermarket is and how it functions generally in society by age 15 or 20, it will not be due to whether or not the topic was well taught at age 6. The educational task is to ensure that when 15-year-olds look at a supermarket, they will see it not as a routine part of the everyday environment, but as a small miracle. Their understanding must be such as to see not just the superficial surface, but to have that surface as a symbol for a rich appreciation of the wonderful achievements that underlie it. I have discussed the content very much at an adult level, relying on teachers being better able than I am to work out ways of implementing principles for the classroom. I should, nevertheless, perhaps reiterate that the point is not to teach children about survival and destruction. Underlying this whole alternative approach is the observation that children already know those concepts in some profound way. The point is to use them to make sense of new material. Clearly, children may not be able to provide explicit definitions of survival or destruction, but we can be sure they know them because they easily make sense of stories whose meaning requires understanding of such concepts. While the choice of binary opposites provides us with powerful organizers, it does not determine the way we value a topic. In the way I have discussed organizing the content so far, it is clear that we are seeing the community as positively valuable without any qualifications. We could organize the content quite differently to give quite a different view. For the sake of example, I will move to the other extreme and draw on another important way of making things engaging for young children. I have already discussed the importance of children being able to make sense of things by means of their most highly developed ways of grasping the world. Among these grasping or grappling tools are the ability to make sense of things in terms of human intentions, emotions, hopes, fears, etc. By personalizing the impersonal, we can use these tools. We might, then, vivify our image of the community as an organism by suggesting that children think of the community as a creature. Going back in time, the teacher can describe it, using visual representations, as a small creature who settled down by the local river. As the years went by, it grew by drinking the pure water, and dirtying it as it passed through, and by eating away at the surrounding land. It became bigger and fatter and more monstrous, and grew faster and faster. It sent tentacles, roads, deep into the countryside to get food from more and more distant places to satisfy its ever-growing appetite, destroying the natural woods and meadows. Some tentacles ripped up the land to get minerals and fuels which it ate in its factories, dirtying further the land, air, and water. It became bigger and noisier. It is greedy and selfish, sprawling across hills and valleys, eating everything in its way. It, like us, is trying to grow and survive and overwhelm the threats to its destruction. I am not here recommending one or the other way of presenting the material. Rather, I am trying to show only that using this model does not commit us to any particular value position. Its contribution is that it helps to select and organize material to be more meaningful and engaging to children and more beneficial. As in a good story, this model guides us to tie each element to the strong and clear underlying structure, which is made from affectively engaging binary opposites. 4. Conclusion. What is the best way of resolving the dramatic conflict inherent in the binary opposites? What degree of mediation of those opposites is it appropriate to seek? Following this model, we need to find some way of bringing our unit to a close that is more like the way a story ends than simply stopping because we have run out of material. The survival-destruction theme has provided a structure to our unit, and so in conclusion, we need to resolve in some way the dramatic conflict set up between them. The resolution may take the form of a mediation, or as a confirmation of a particular perspective. A confirmation of the wonderful achievement of the community in providing for our needs and desires might be presented by means of a concluding story which brings together all the material dealt with. Such a story might have as its wicked protagonist a monster who tries to destroy a community. The body of the story could be made up of the monster's various attacks and the community's defenses. The monster sets fires. The fire brigade puts them out, smashes up roads to prevent food coming in. The repair crews fix them, and so on. Alternatively, the children, in small groups perhaps, might argue about which feature of the community contributes most towards its protection. The teacher might prepare roles, giving each a group a card with the feature it is to argue for and some main points around which it might build a case. For example, police protect us from robbers and murderers and keep the traffic moving safely so that goods can be driven to the stores and we can drive to the stores to get food. Schools provide us with knowledge so that people can read and write and so survive in our literate society, and provide an introduction to the arts of civilized living that make communities work, and provide introductions to technical skills necessary for keeping our machines running. Cards can be prepared on all the other agencies of the community touched on in the unit. The teacher's role in such a guided discussion can be to point out that these roles are not really in competition, but that they cooperate to keep the community going. We might decide to conclude by seeking a mediation between our binary organizers. To do this, we would need to show that a community is dynamic and alive as a result of its constant struggle to survive. Only by being energetic and fending off all the threats to survival does the community exist as such. The community lives, then, in the balance of survival destruction. If the threats all vanished, we would no longer need communities. We can see how features of communities change and sometimes evaporate as particular threats to survival appear. We no longer need walls around our communities, and so we do not need night watchers and all those others whose community function was either building, care, or guarding of the walls. We no longer need horses for transportation, and so the feeding, protection, shoeing, etc. of horses no longer provides employment to community members. No doubt, experienced teachers can come up with a number of other ways of implementing these ideas. The guiding principle here is that we need to resolve, in some degree, the conflict between survival and destruction. We need to work out some way of bringing together the material dealt with in the body of the unit and showing clearly the relationship between the binary organizers. As we began with some vivid exposition of the dramatic conflict between the two, so we end with some vivid resolution of that conflict. Above, I have suggested conclusions that show all the aspects of the community working in dynamic cooperation to keep the social organization in equilibrium. 5. Evaluation. How can one know whether the topic has been understood, its importance grasped, and the content learned? The important educational task of this unit is to attach children's concepts of survival, destruction, to knowledge about their community. By this means, they will be able to make sense of their community as something dynamic, wonderful, and important. They attach profound abstract concepts, perhaps mainly elaborated in fantasy and stories, to reality. How do we evaluate our success at this? The danger, so evident in so much test-driven teaching practice, is that we accept as evidence of learning success something other than what is educationally important. Because it is so difficult to work out how to measure the educationally important achievement, we measure instead what seems an index of that achievement. The easiest thing to measure is what knowledge is remembered some short time after the unit is completed. This kind of measure accounts for a great deal of educational evaluation, and is taken as an index of the more important lesson taught. We can, of course, learn much from such sensitive evaluation, but this model does not contribute anything significant that I can see to the evaluation of the learning the model encourages. Because of its focus on more complex and important learning, this model might be seen as making the evaluator's task that little bit harder. But in general, the usual array of evaluation procedures can be brought to bear at the conclusion of, or during, a lesson or unit. A lesson on the Vikings. For the second example of the model at work, I have chosen a topic normally considered inappropriate for elementary school children. Among the reasons for excluding it from the elementary school curriculum are those which I have discussed above, as derived from the presently influential ad hoc principles. Part of my purpose here, then, is to demonstrate that one can indeed organize a lesson on the Vikings in a way that is meaningful, engaging, and educationally valuable for young children. This lesson, let us assume, is a part of a unit on world history. Let us further assume that we are presenting this unit as the story of a struggle for civilization against barbarism. Such an overall binary theme would then focus us particularly onto topics in which that struggle is most evident. Hence, the Vikings. We could alternatively, or additionally, look at world history as a story of the struggle between freedom and tyranny, or security and danger, or knowledge and ignorance, or any number of themes, each of which would focus attention onto somewhat different historical material. It may be thought that young children will likely not have much grasp on such concepts as civilization or barbarism. This may appear to be a double problem for the model, as it is not just a matter of getting children to learn them, as that these are the concepts we are expecting them to learn with. That is, the basic assumption of this model is that children have these concepts available to use in grasping new knowledge about the world. Again, while children typically would be unable to define explicitly what civilization or barbarism is, there is a clear sense in which they profoundly understand such concepts. Civilization is, most simply, the forms of behavior which make living together most generally easy. Tolerance, self-control, and self-restraint. Ability to share, willingness to contribute to the general welfare. Barbarism is the lack of these civilizing virtues. In families, in the classroom, in the schoolyard, and in the neighborhood, children learn about such things, well or badly. While they may not know what tolerance or its opposite are explicitly, they understand them precisely in their exclusion from games on arbitrary grounds. They understand self-restraint and its opposite in their own or other children's berserk behavior. When, for example, they learn about the Viking berserkers, they will have no trouble understanding that warriors can fight with a frenzied fury in which they do not calculate, as in normal behavior, the consequences of their actions. Family life and the schoolyard provide a microcosm of the forces that have shaped the history of the world and its struggle for civilized life against the ever-present forces of barbarism. The educational task for this lesson is to extend their concepts from their local experience and attach them to one part of the real history of their world. 1. Identifying importance. What is most important about the topic? Why should it matter to children? What is affectively engaging about it? I have answered these questions largely in the introduction above. What matters about this topic at this time in children's lives is that they begin to understand that the conflicts they see in their families and neighborhoods and schools and the conflicts they feel within themselves are analogous to those that have shaped history. In addition, they will begin to understand that civilized life is a tenuous thing where it has survived by the skin of its teeth. Our lesson may be designed in order to make this point vividly and spell out that the same barbaric forces are present all the time and that the values of tolerance, self-restraint, and so on are essential for all of us to practice as prerequisites to civilized life. What is affectively engaging about all this is that the emotions, impulses, hopes, and fears which animate this episode of history are vividly a part of children's lives. 2. Finding binary opposites. What powerful binary opposites best catch the importance of the topic? This lesson is one of a series, each of which carries forward the theme of civilization struggling against barbarism. This is one perspective through which the human story can be told. Though all aspects of the struggle between Vikings and the realms to their south, west, and east cannot be told from this perspective, it allows us to tell something important about those times. As this lesson is a part of a larger unit, we will build it upon the binary opposites of the overarching story. Each lesson, then, serves to carry forward and add to the general unit, much as an episode in a soap opera carries forward a general story while being a mini-story itself. So we will organize our lesson on the Vikings in terms of the struggle between civilization and barbarism. 3. Organizing content into story form. 3.1. What content most dramatically embodies the binary opposites in order to provide access to the topic? We might begin with an image of the monks at Lindisfarne at work. Part of their role was to preserve the knowledge left by the now-destroyed Roman Empire, a look at which might have been the subject of a previous lesson. Examples of monks' writing could be shown. Perhaps the enlarged pages of the Book of Kells might serve. The monks can be shown working in their fields, tending their animals, studying and writing in a scriptorium. Then strangers are seen. The strangers are carrying weapons and are running. The monks outside run back to their monastery. They bar the doors. Nothing can keep the Vikings out. They break in, kill the monks, steal whatever looks valuable, burn and destroy everything else, and take the novices, young monks, as slaves. This first attack was in 793 AD, long after English kingdoms had been set up. It is enough for children to place the incident in a causal sequence a long time after the Roman Empire fell, a long, long time ago. Our beginning can conclude with the questions people at the time had after the first raids. Who were the Vikings? Where did they come from? This opening incident needs to dramatize the contributions the monks were making to civilization and the wanton destructiveness of the Vikings. That the idea of a monk and preserver of knowledge from a past better time is easily made comprehensible to children can be seen from the analogous image of Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars. This dweller in the wilderness with relics of a past civilization is not, of course, the same as a monk, and Darth Vader's stormtroopers are not the same as Vikings, but the concepts in each case are no less comprehensible. And of course, children may not be able to fully understand what a monk is, but within the story, the meaning of monk and monastery begins to take on definition. 3.2. What content best articulates the topic into a developing story form? The next part of the lesson can be spent briefly explaining that Europe was made up of realms with lots of kings, each ruling over lands made up mainly of small towns and villages. If a king did not know where or when an attack was coming, he could do little to protect his towns and villages. The Vikings raided without warning. They were berserk fighters, fearless themselves and merciless to others. Women and children were slaughtered as the Vikings burned and destroyed everything they could not steal. We need to focus our story and might choose to make central to this lesson the remarkable figure of Alfred the Great. Because of our theme, we will need to bring out the fact that Alfred was a beacon of civilization in a barbaric time. From boyhood, his life was spent fighting and running from Vikings, fighting and being defeated by them, and fighting them again and again. Despite this, he gathered around him scholars. He himself learned to read, a rare accomplishment in those days, and later in life learned Latin. He gathered documents and organized translations into English. He set up a school for the children of his lords. This strange warrior king, almost always on the move, struggling to hold his kingdom together, was a founder of English cultural life. We can convey some image of this to children by stressing his love of knowledge and the arts of gentle and civilized life, and that, even so, he was, reluctantly, one of the greatest warriors. Our central story, then, will be of Alfred's constant defeats and the cruelty and destructiveness of the various Viking raiding parties. Children should learn the names of Viking leaders like Ragnar Lothbrok, Eric Bloodaxe, Ivar the Boneless, Halfdan, and Guthrum. In their conquest, they destroyed monasteries across England, destroying the civilizing knowledge contained in their manuscripts. In a story, one does not need to explain why a manuscript is valuable if the story shows its value by the horror people felt at its loss. The efforts of Alfred to preserve and add to the manuscripts of the English again shows their importance in a way that does not need further explanation. A key incident in our story will be Alfred's hiding in the marsh island of Athelney. From there, he sent out the call to his nobles and churls. They came from far and wide until Alfred could lead out an army that destroyed the power of Guthrum at Edington. Instead of trying to kill every last enemy, Alfred aimed to civilize them too, and to live in peace with them. He required that Guthrum become a Christian, and agreed to his settling with the remains of his armies in the east of England. In 1899, King Alfred died in peace, recognized as King of the English as no king before him had been. Clearly, one would not tell the story of Alfred in these terms. Again, I am assuming that teachers will see many of the ways this basic plotline can be taught. My concern here is to show how our basic binary theme helps us to select and organize the content which will best convey what is important. In order to teach such a lesson to children, certain visual resources are desirable. Because we have for so long excluded such topics from our early school curricula and assumed that children can understand only the local, the immediate, the concrete, the simple, and what they can actively manipulate, we lack appropriate resources that are easily accessible. If the principles I am supporting in this book become more widely accepted, then perhaps we may see such materials produced in profusion. Here, I want only to lay out the way in which one might organize a lesson on the Vikings in a story form, and using concepts that children would find easily comprehensible, and indeed engaging. 4. Conclusion. What is the best way of resolving the dramatic conflict inherent in the binary opposites? What degree of mediation of those opposites is it appropriate to seek? One might conclude in a number of ways. We could deal with Alfred's achievement in preserving and extending civilization, even among the Vikings. In such a conclusion, we might consider that Alfred was more ready to be defeated and get up and fight again than the Vikings were ready to defeat him. Civilized life, in his view, offers more to live for and more to fight for than does barbarism. Even the victorious barbarians come to see it in the end. It is easier to destroy than to build. But something in the joy of building outlasts the shallow pleasure of destruction. Perhaps better might be a mediation in which we recognize the Viking contributions as well. We might note that our knowledge of the Viking raids comes mainly from the monks' writings. They present them as simply evil, a curse sent for people's sins. We might in contrast consider how just a few thousand men, twice or four times, or however many times, more than there are children in the school, set out in open ships from their villages in Scandinavia. A ship could carry perhaps 40 men and sometimes their horses too. In a few years, they destroyed much of London and Paris, Hamburg and Antwerp, Bordeaux and Seville, Morocco and the Rhone villages. They founded Russia and besieged Constantinople. They settled and took over Normandy, Sicily, and Iceland. They discovered Greenland and America, and united England and Denmark under Knut. Through their raids, Moorish slaves were to be found in their town of Dublin, and piles of English coins were found in Russia. They were afraid of nothing, neither kings, armies, God, or the cold. In the end, they won the battle for England, when the Viking descendant William of Normandy conquered the country in 1066. Their fierce energy contributed to rebuilding the civilization they very nearly destroyed. It is an odd story in which perhaps civilization conquered the Vikings in the end. 5. Evaluation. How can one know whether the topic has been understood, its importance grasped, and the content learned? I have nothing much to add to the comments made under this section in the unit on communities. We need to be careful that we focus our evaluation on what is important. Do the children understand further the constant battle between civilization and barbarism? Has the story of Alfred and the Vikings refined further their understanding of civilization and of barbarism? degrees of refinement of understanding are difficult to measure. Conclusion. Here, then, are outlined plans for a unit and a lesson using the alternative model. What it does is focus our attention on what matters most about any topic and direct us to articulate what matters on the kind of powerful concepts which children use most easily to grasp new knowledge. From the outlined plans here to teaching practice, there is still a step to take. It is the step of finding the most vivid illustration of an incident, collecting the best resource materials, deciding what tasks to give the children, considering what questions can help them appreciate something more fully, choosing helpful analogies for events and incidents, and so on. There are many books about this level of preparing for teaching practice, and school staff rooms and teachers' conferences are rich in lore for assisting with this aspect of teaching. The contribution of this book is limited to what seems to me the crucial task of selecting and organizing topics. Clearly, this overlaps with the level mentioned above, and properly should provide the plan which those tasks fill out and make more precise. As with any new model, on first acquaintance, it may seem complicated. This is due in part, at least, to its being different from what we are accustomed to. After so much exposure and the almost universal assertion that we must begin units and lessons by stating objectives, the presently dominant model can come to seem natural. This alternative model, which nowhere mentions objectives, is, I hope it is clear, based on principles which are certainly no less sound, and possibly much more sound, than those on which the objectives, content, methods, evaluation model rests. After some practice using it, I think it will be found to be a much more natural way to approach planning teaching. I hope the examples I have given in this chapter show how it can be used and that its use encourages more educationally valuable teaching. I hope also that it can be seen how it encourages teaching, which is likely to be routinely meaningful and engaging to children.